good horse, I called you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go right.
You're listening to episode 521 of Unwelcome Guests, Walling Us In and the Illusion of Separation. I'm Robin Upton. This week on the show, we're looking at the increasingly graphic measures to which governments are going to try to separate us and to keep us physically in our place. I remember when the Berlin Wall came down and apartheid also collapsed at a similar time. There was a very optimistic feeling, a feeling of coming together, a feeling of ending the division. But, as we shall hear on the show tonight, governments are building walls at an unprecedented rate. I had to work hard to squeeze this content into the two-hour show, so you won't hear much more from me. We're going to start with George Draffen recalling the origin of the national passport system as we know it today, which is something that, although it's been an ever-present reality for almost all of almost everyone's life, is actually been going in its modern form for less than a century. So here's George Draffen on that.
After the events of 9/11 and the rush to war, the question came up: how much security do we need? How tight do we want to make the borders in the United States? How much surveillance should we do of people who come in from other countries with passports? Those questions naturally arose. How secure can we make the country, and how far do we want to go? Is there a balance with privacy? Is there a balance with freedom? And I think Derek and I came to the conclusion that it's a false choice, that privacy is actually an illusion. It's a distraction from bigger questions about who's got power over who. And it's a distraction from the larger question of freedom and power and how society is constructed and how we live our lives. And as we looked at the historical record, we discovered some pretty shocking things. I mean, criminals at least from the Middle Ages on, criminals were often tattooed, or they'd even have their ears docked to mark them as criminals. It was a way of identifying people, sorting people, branding people. And about the time in the 1800s, early 1800s, when this began to be frowned upon, democracy was rising and political revolutions, 1848, there were revolutions in Europe. The harsh treatment of prisoners and poor people began to be frowned on. And about this time, fingerprints were discovered. People had unique fingerprints. And also, about this time, photography was invented. And within 10 years of the invention of photography, over 500,000 gypsies had been photographed in Europe. People that were itinerant, they traveled around, they didn't hold jobs, they didn't have property, they weren't under anybody's control. But within a decade of the invention of photography, over 500,000 of them had been photographed in Germany and in Switzerland especially, but in other countries also. And those photographs were put in a file so that they could be tracked. And if there were crimes committed, a database of people that were suspect could be searched. And we discovered that with passports, with any kind of identification, whether it's criminal, it soon becomes applied to the population at large. Passports begin to be used. Any time there's a war, the security apparatus gets cranked up, and then after the war, it never goes away. So passports were used first as a wartime measure, and often to keep draft-age young men from leaving the country. Passports were originally used to keep people from leaving the country rather than for people entering the country. But by the time of World War I, passports were required for travel in Europe between countries. After the war, those requirements were not lifted. And we see the same thing after 9/11. The Patriot Act was first passed as a temporary emergency measure to protect the country in a time of war, and now, of course, those provisions are becoming permanent. So that's that obsession with security starts out usually during war, during times of crisis, and there's a rationale for it. We're afraid, and so we go for security over privacy and freedom. But with passing decades, we lose more and more of our freedom. Once something begins to be used, either politically or administratively or technologically, it tends to become a permanent feature of society.
Our next speaker is Canadian anti-globalization activist Jaggi Singh. This entire speech is about an hour and a quarter. I had to squeeze it into about three quarters of an hour. If you feel like listening to the whole thing, it's downloadable from this show's website at unwelcomeguests.net/521.
I'm going to talk about migration, about this campaign that's emerged internationally called No One is Illegal. And basically it's a framework, a lens by which to look at our society globally and domestically, a way of understanding globalization, of capitalism, of war. It's a huge topic. Migration, immigration, refugee issues, these affect tens of millions of people. I think it actually affects all of us indirectly, but it affects tens of millions of people directly. And what I want to do is look at the lived reality of people who are migrants or immigrants and refugees and look at some of the very radical conclusions that can be drawn by trying to analyze this phenomenon of migration. This phenomenon of migration that has led to quite significant campaigns. The campaigns that are emerging in Canada are quite small. We're taking our baby steps, but these campaigns have emerged and are very strong in places like Western Europe with No Border campaigns, in Australia, where No One is Legal campaigns emerged in the 90s. In the U.S., it's been very strong. So I want to look at this phenomenon of migration, which in the end is very subversive of the idea of nation states and is something I think we should all get familiar with. So a starting point, I guess, is this idea of migration and understanding and acknowledging the fact that every year, there are 175 million people that are crossing national borders permanently. Those are United Nations statistics, updated statistics. That's double what it was 10 years ago, a decade ago, and it's expected to double in another 10 years. That 175 million people who are crossing national borders, that doesn't take into account the people who are displaced internally within their countries, like in Colombia or within the Congo, for example. So 175 million people on the move every year. That's an unprecedented number of human beings on the move ever in human history. Just in sheer numbers of people, that's never been seen in human history. And as I said, it's expected to double in another decade. Talking about the statistics, though, you know, 175 million people, doesn't do justice at all to the nature of these journeys, the tragedies that occur as people move. For example, ferries that sink, that are overloaded with migrants. Just to give one example, in 2000, there was a ferry that was traveling from Indonesia to Australia, and the ferry was full of migrants from Palestine, from Algeria, from Iraq, and Afghanistan. The ferry was so overcrowded that it cracked in two, and over 300 people drowned in the straits off of Indonesia on the way to Australia. Over 100 of those people were children. So that's migration. And the fact is this migration of 175 million people, each of whom has a story, often ending in death, often ending in sickness or in detention camps or in refugee camps or in clandestine lives, it's not an arbitrary kind of migration. And basically it's the movement of people from southern countries, from the so-called third world, from the colonized world to the first world, to countries like Canada or the United States in North America or to Western Europe, or to Australia and New Zealand, or even to places like Israel, which has the second highest number of foreign migrants per capita after Switzerland, and also the rich Arab states. This is a reflection of a global apartheid, where if by chance you happen to have a passport that comes from Canada or the US or Western Europe, you have certain mobility, you have certain rights, you have certain opportunities. And if you don't have those passports, you're going to be highly motivated, depending on your circumstances, to go to those places and to get those passports. That's a reflection of apartheid, a global apartheid, that I'm going to get back to later on in my talk. So, you know, why are people moving? It might seem like an obvious question, but I think we should look at it, because the reasons for migration, and migration has been around ever since human beings have been around, but the reason for these levels of migration in this particular historical era can be traced. This is not a sudden curiosity by brown and yellow and black people to tear themselves away from their homelands and from their networks of support and just, you know, go on these incredible journeys to go somewhere else. I mean, there are reasons why people are leaving. We can look at the destruction of rural communities and rural economies, growing unemployment. There is an estimated 150 million people that are completely jobless in the world, growing worldwide poverty, war and militarization, forced eviction, such as the issue of Palestinian refugees, by government or state forces. These are all reasons, and these have been the same reasons that we've had for decades and decades for why people migrate. It's something that we have to remind ourselves of in this context of scapegoating of immigrants and refugees, those very sound reasons why someone might tear themselves away from a support network and their homeland and go somewhere else. This is part of our history. One of the other great waves of migration was in the 17th and 18th century of Brits, you know, English people and Scottish people, Irish, Germans, Scandinavians, who left their homelands because of industrialization and industrial revolution. Traditional ways of life were torn apart and they left. Today we have industrialization and a new kind of industrial revolution in somewhere like China, for example, which is the reason why we have so many Chinese migrants whose ways of life have been displaced. And yet, we don't see their journeys and we don't see their acts of self-determination in quite the same way as we celebrate British and Irish migrants who came here earlier. So you have this migration on an unprecedented level for good reasons. These incredible journeys, as I described, heroic journeys. And so at exactly the same time you have this unprecedented level of human movement, you have unprecedented barriers going up to that movement, to people's ability to get from one point to another point. And those barriers, of course, are being put up in those former colonizing nations or these colonial settler states in the USA and Canada and New Zealand and Australia and Western Europe. They give it names. The policymakers in these countries give these barriers names. Tony Blair and Jacques Chirac agreed on one thing. They disagreed on the Iraq War, but they agreed about the creation of Fortress Europe, which is the exact name they gave to these policies to keep out Eastern Europeans and North Africans from getting into Europe. Fortress Europe, a term that was borrowed, of course, by John Manley and John Ashcroft and Tom Ridge, the other policymakers now, to create Fortress North America. Very distinct policy decisions that are creating this so-called fortress around North America. In Australia and New Zealand, they don't use the term fortress. Instead, they talk about the Pacific solution. And we have to ask ourselves, you know, a fortress against who? A solution against who? The language is racist because, of course, there's a nature to this migration. Another point to keep in mind, of course, is these very countries, Canada, the U.S., the countries of Western Europe, are the countries that pat themselves on the back for being most open to immigrants and refugees, you know, and celebrating the fact that they take in refugees. Another statistic that is very telling is 70% of those 175 million people that are moving every year, 70% of those people end up migrating to another third world country. Those millions, and there were millions, of Afghanis who fled Afghanistan in the 80s and the 90s and the beginning of 2000s, they didn't go to the US or to Canada or to Australia. They weren't airlifted out by our humane governments. In the millions, they are now occupying refugee camps in Pakistan and in Iran. They were the recipients of astounding support and mutual aid by people who have nothing. I attended a talk in Montreal by an activist, Sarvat Vikar, who visited the refugee camps on the border of Pakistan and Afghanistan and talked to the people who made those journeys and talked about how during those journeys they were given food and they were given shelter by Afghanis that were basically dealing with a war and yet were able to provide a spot where people could have rest and food and water on their way to Pakistan and on their way to a refugee camp. This incredible support that was offered by people who have nothing, by countries that are so-called third world countries that don't have the resources that Canada and the U.S. have, and yet it's the countries of Fortress North America and Fortress Europe and the Pacific Solution that celebrate their so-called openness to immigrants and refugees. One thing to keep in mind is these policies, and I'm going to go into the policies in a second, these policies aren't necessarily meant to keep people out. There are immigrants that come to these countries. There are immigrants. Canada accepts approximately 200,000 immigrants every year, immigrants and refugees every year. They're not meant to keep people out. What these policies do is make people's lives unstable. It makes people more exploitable. It makes people less sure of their rights in a given country because they're not given full status. as anyone else would expect in a given nation. These policies aren't meant to keep people out, because if you just look at the nature of work in countries like Canada or the U.S. in Western Europe, especially in urban centers, around urban centers, and you think about who's pumping gas, who's working in the backs of fast food kitchens, who's working in agricultural fields, you know, picking cabbage and fruit. When you think about who's working in sweatshops, sewing clothes in our countries, if you think about who's working in construction, you begin to get an idea of what this labor is doing. And when you think about the exploitation that occurs in those fields and in those areas of work, a huge amount of that work is done by non-status people, by illegal people. You begin to understand how these policies aren't meant to keep people out, but it's meant to control the people once they're here. That's an important point about understanding Fortress North America. Fortress North America is about managing migration, making that migration acceptable for the interests of capital in our countries. In Canada, Fortress North America has been imposed in some very specific ways since September 11th, 2001, but also beforehand. There's three pillars of Fortress North America in Canada. They are the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, the Safe Third Country Agreement, and the so-called Smart Border. The Immigration and Refugee Protection Act was introduced before September 11th. So these policies aren't necessarily traced to the scapegoating and the attacks on immigrant and refugee populations after September 11th. These policies were being conceived of beforehand as well, and certainly the climate after September 11th gave the Liberals in this case an excuse to sort of rush through with the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, which allows for more detentions, which allows for limited appeals. Appeals are made by single judges now for refugees. If you think about it for a second, these appeals are for life or death cases in many cases. And before you had two people, so you had that extra check or that extra balance of having two people being sure of whether or not sending this person back would result in their death or serious injury. Now there's a single person who does the appeal. Banning of welfare recipients of sponsoring people to come to Canada, and on, basically making immigration that much more difficult. That's the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act. Safe Third Country is part of Fortress North America. What Safe Third Country is allowing Canada to deport immediately, without a hearing, anyone that comes from a so-called Safe Third Country, a country that Canada determines to be safe. Importantly, the U.S. is one of those Safe Third Countries. According to refugee advocates, that means up to 40% of people who previously were considered for refugee claims can have their claims completely rejected and sent right back to the U.S., right off the bat. That's 40% of people who are currently making claims cut off from the process with the Safe Third Country policy that has been passed but hasn't been implemented yet, but it's going to be implemented this year, according to the immigration minister. Keep in mind that in the 80s, the U.S., just to give one example, I mean, there are many examples, but in the 80s, the U.S. would routinely deport people back to countries like Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, while Canada would accept them as refugees, because the U.S. has its own geopolitical considerations for what's a refugee. You know, only if you're from Cuba, you're a refugee, but otherwise you're not, according to the U.S. So that's a Safe Third Country, and it's an incredible attack on the ability of people to find refuge in a country like Canada. The third pillar of Fortress North America is something called the Smart Border. What the Smart Border is essentially the militarization of the Canadian-American border. The use of the National Guard, for example, the National Guard is now deployed on the border, on the Canadian-U.S. border. It's always been deployed with other military forces on the Mexican-American border. The introduction of such things as Project Identity, which is all about fingerprinting and setting up new files and sharing files between various countries of people who are crossing the border. Part of the Smart Border is the creation of the Northern Command. The U.S. Military apparatus has a command structure. They literally carve up the globe into commands. Central Command, which is based in Tampa, Florida, well, which is now in Qatar, is responsible for the entire Middle East region, for example. Southern Command, which is based in Miami, is responsible for Central America and all of South America. When we think about imperialism, and people think that's kind of extreme to talk about imperialism, think about the American military structure and the way they divide up the world into their commands. Well, now they have Northern Command, which is responsible for Canada and the U.S. It's quite insidious, this whole command structure, because on the one hand, let's say Southern Command is responsible for implementing Plan Colombia in Colombia, which is creating incredible displacement and creating a refugee crisis in Colombia, as well as Bolivia and in other places in the Andes. Or if you look at Central Command, which you know is responsible for bombing in Somalia and bombing in Afghanistan and bombing in Iraq, creating a whole other wave of refugees. So you have one part of this command structure creating refugees and creating displaced people. And now you have Northern Command ready with their M16s and their tanks and their Apaches and everything else to meet them if they try to come to the U.S. or to Canada. And of course, you know, we can look at the economics of this. Part of the FTAA, the Free Trade Area of the Americas, is something called Plan Puebla Panama. Plan Puebla Panama is an infrastructure project for southern Mexico and Central America. Plan Puebla Panama is basically, it's what I call capitalism's great leap forward in that part of the world. It's about building dry canals, airports, transportation facilities, industrializing an area of the world that that has a significant indigenous population and a lot of pristine environment and ecology. Of course, Plan Puebla Panama is going to do what industrialization and that kind of forced economic development always does, create displaced persons in the millions who aren't going to be content to take a job in the airport cleaning it up, for example, which is, you know, which is what's planned for them. And of course, there won't be enough of those jobs for the millions of people who will be displaced. They're going to move north, as they should. They're going to move north to the United States, where the Northern Command is going to wait for them. I outlined so these pillars of how Fortress North America is working. I think it's important, though, to ground ourselves in history. I was here last time and I talked about that. But in terms of immigrant and refugee issues, because again, there's this tendency to sort of look back nostalgically on you know, the era when Canada was nice. You know, sometime in the, I don't know, 40s or 50s when, I don't know. There's that tendency, this nostalgia for Canada that once was. Well, let's remind ourselves of Canada's views towards immigrants and refugees. I'm going to limit myself to the 20th century. For example, there used to be a head tax on Chinese who tried to come here. The same Chinese migrants, by the way, that were responsible for some of the most dangerous and dirty tasks in building the railroad. It's been estimated by a Chinese organization that for every kilometer of railroad, there's a dead Chinese migrant that was using dynamite or what have you. There used to be a head tax on Chinese. There used to be a dead de facto whites-only immigration policy right up until the 1950s, de facto, with things like the head tax. In the late 1930s and 1940s, we had a policy against Jewish refugees from Nazi-occupied Europe. That policy was called none is too many. That is, you know, having none of them is just too many. And by that standard, Jewish refugees were kept from coming to Canada. The classic definition of a refugee, Jews who were fleeing Nazi-occupied Europe. Of course, we can talk about the internment of the Japanese and on and on. Now, I bring all this up because the parallels are there today. This isn't about saying, oh, that's just the past, and isn't that too bad, and we've apologized for the head tax, we've apologized for the internment of the Japanese. You know, there's now museums that are being built to recognize what happened to the Kamigata Maru, etc. Well, let's look at what's happening today. For example, I mentioned the head tax against Chinese migrants. Well, we have the modern-day equivalent of a head tax, and that's the fact that for anybody who wants to make a humanitarian and compassionate grounds claim to come to Canada as a refugee, they have to pay $550 per head, which is an extraordinary barrier to people making those claims. I know personally Algerians and Palestinians who the No One Is Legal campaign is working with in Montreal, who are unable to make those humanitarian and compassionate grounds claim because for their family, a husband and a wife and kids, that's $550 for each head. The children get charged less, but still, that's an incredible barrier. And of course, it's a barrier that's aimed against certain types of migrants. I talked about riots against Chinese and Japanese. Now, there haven't been race riots against immigrant populations in Canada since there were riots against Jews in Toronto in the 1930s, anti-Semitic riots against Jews in Toronto in the 1930s. There have been riots against Aboriginal peoples, of course, race riots in Oka, for example, but not against immigrant populations. Fortunately, there haven't been. But these regressive immigration laws that are brought in, such as the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, are always brought in after a racist scare with regards to immigrants and refugees. For example, the Mulroney government in the late 1980s brought in their own regressive immigration laws after one boatload of Tamils and one boatload of Sikhs landed off the East Coast. One landed in Newfoundland and one landed in Nova Scotia. I'm not sure if people remember back in the 1980s, but it created this huge fuss. Canada in 1991 would go to war against Iraq without recalling Parliament. They did that, okay? But In the late 1980s, the Mulroney government recalled Parliament to pass immigration law, regressive immigration law, in response to the racist scare that was going on at the time in response to Sikhs and Tamils that landed off the coast of the East Coast. The Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, as I mentioned, was brought in before September 11th. It was brought in response to another racist backlash that happened in 1999, just 4 years ago. You know, this is all recent history. This is part of our contemporary reality. This backlash was against the landing of approximately 600 Chinese migrants with two boatloads off the West Coast. The response at the time was astounding, the racism. For example, the Victoria Times columnist, the main newspaper in Victoria, had a headline that said, "Go home," in response to this. A few days later, they had another front page story about a dog that gave birth to some puppies on one of the ships, and about how the SPCA in Victoria was overrun by phone calls expressing concern for these puppies. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm all for animal welfare, and it's good that people were concerned about these puppies on the ship. But meanwhile, you had men, women, and children who were detained, immediately detained, in isolated areas of BC, cut away from, you know, support networks and what have you. The 90 people were put on a plane and eventually deported. The enforcement agents for Immigration Canada spent over $2,000 to produce commemorative T-shirts, golf shirts with collars, which had on it Class of 90. Class of 90, not referring to the year 1990, but referring to the 90 people that they had deported. So you had this incredible racism at the time, which manifested itself eventually in the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, which makes it difficult for immigrants and refugees to come here. I talked about the none is too many policy against Jewish refugees in the 1930s and 40s. Well, refugee rights advocates have called the Safe Third Country Agreement a none is too many policy. Because what we're saying is, if you come through the U.S., and if you're from Latin America, you will come through the U.S., none is too many. We're going to send you right back. I talked about the internment of Japanese Canadians, and of course Japanese Americans were also interned during World War II. Now, as many right-wing commentators always remind us, we haven't been detaining all Arabs and Muslims into detention centers, and supposedly, you know, this is a reflection of how things progress. Well, first of all, thousands of Arab and Muslim men and Pakistani men were rounded up in New Jersey, in New York. Neighborhoods were surrounded by teams that rounded them up and put them into detention centers on very minor immigration violations, if that. Only like two or three people out of those thousands that were rounded up had any connection whatsoever to terrorism. You know, we talk about internment. Well, we have a modern-day form of internment, which is called registration in the United States. The U.S. has a list of almost three dozen countries, mainly Muslim and Arab countries. And if you come from those countries, you are required to go into an INS office and register. Registration means you provide your fingerprints, a photo, you tell them what you're doing, you give them information, which is otherwise known as informing or snitching, and you're registered, and you can stay. Registration is the modern-day form of internment. Because what is fingerprinting people all about? What is taking their photo all about? What is providing those updated addresses all about? What is providing that information all about? And when you don't provide that information, you're more suspicious in their eyes. It's about controlling people. And of course, you can control them in one way, which is round them all up and put them in a detention center. But another way of controlling them is forcing them to register. And if they don't register, suddenly they're illegal and be rounded up and deported from the country. According to the New York Times, there are 17,000 people who are rounded up post September 11th that they're getting ready to deport. And of course, the people who are being registered are in the thousands and thousands and thousands. This is the equivalent of the internment of the Japanese. It's the technologically appropriate way of doing so. They didn't have those digital technologies back in the 40s. They didn't have the means to surveil a population that they do now. Another point I want to make about Canadian immigration policies is beyond these three pillars of Fortress North America that I talked about, there are structural flaws to immigration refugee policies. To be an immigrant to this country, you need to fulfill a certain number of points. You get points when you fill out that form. So you speak English, you get a certain amount of points. You have a degree, you get more points. If your degree's in engineering, even more. You know, all of that stuff. But the point system is structured, and it's been changed, of course, through policy change. It's structured such that you need to basically be Superman or Superwoman to be an immigrant to Canada. You know, I exaggerate slightly, But there was an interesting article that was written taking some famous Canadians and applying the point system to them and seeing if they were trying to immigrate to Canada, if they would get in. And apparently only Pierre Burton, Margaret Atwood would, and everybody else wouldn't. So, you know, kudos to all those immigrants who are getting in. There are future Pierre Burtons and Margaret Atwoods. That's immigration policy. You know, this point system that is so skewed against the immigrant reality, against what it means to be an immigrant. Another way of looking at it is, think of immigrant populations in cities like Toronto, Montreal, Winnipeg, Vancouver. Okay, I'm a son of immigrants. If the point system today was applied to my mother and to my father, or to a lot of your parents, they would not get into this country. They would not get into this country. And this is the glorious, liberal, multicultural government that's bringing this in. Something to remind ourselves of. And in terms of refugee policy, you basically have to prove you have a gun to your head, an immediate risk of dying to be accepted as a refugee, which of course does no justice to the reality of what a refugee is. Just to give one example, one of the non-status Algerians who was trying to claim refugee status in Montreal, she worked in a daycare center in Algiers. She worked in a daycare center, and daycare centers are often targeted by extremists in Algeria because women work in them. They're daycares. That means that women are leaving their kids there to go to work. Certain extremists don't like that, and their response is to bomb them. So she said, I work in a daycare center. I'm seen as a certain type of woman. She wore hijab, by the way, so it sort of belies all these stereotypes of Muslim women anyways, all the racist stereotypes. Anyway, she said, I'm threatened. And Immigration Canada told her, well, no, you have no immediate threat. Nobody wrote you a letter saying you're going to be killed, so we don't think there's a threat to your life. That's the kind of reality that refugees are dealing with. So the movement I'm talking about here, the No One Is Legal campaign, Open Borders campaigns, Operation Homeland Resistance, these campaigns that are about the struggles of immigrants and refugees and migrants, they're responding to this reality. They're responding to this reality of apartheid. What does that word apartheid mean? Apartheid means separation. It means a separate set of rights. It means certain people's reality is invisible to everybody else. We just don't know about them. And there's a South African style of apartheid, of course. That's where the word comes from. But that reality, that separation, the two sets of rights or separate sets of rights for different groups of people, invisible struggles, that exists in our world, in our society today. Those two realities of illegal people and legal people. Illegal immigrants number in the hundreds of thousands in Canada and in the millions in the U.S. In a city like Los Angeles, you have at least 2 to 3 million illegals living there. An apartheid reality. The idea of separate rights, as I've been alluding to. That invisibility, I think it's important that we remind ourselves of, you know, the realities that exist just, you know, minutes away from where we live. Often, for example, in Montreal, there are Mexican migrants who come under a special program where they're not allowed to have citizenship. They have certain rules they have to abide by, like not drinking and what have you. And what they're allowed to do is work. That's it. They work in agricultural fields around Montreal. I clipped an article from August 28, 2002, last summer, which just a little item in the local paper that referred to 150 of these workers, of 275 of them in this agricultural area just around Montreal in a town called Saint-Hyacinthe, who were going to be deported because on a Friday night they had a party and some of them got drunk and there was a bit of a fight. Nobody got arrested. You can imagine, you know, wanting to party on Friday night, especially if you're working 12, 14, 16-hour days in the hot sun in an agricultural field, and they were deported just like that. Mexicans, Guatemalans, Jamaicans, these are people working in tobacco fields and in agricultural fields all over Canada. That same summer, I became acquainted with the name, Ned Livingston Peart. Ned Livingston Peart was a Jamaican farm worker working in those tobacco fields in southwestern Ontario. Ned Livingston Peart died in August of 2002 because a kiln, a tobacco kiln, fell on him and he died. Farm workers are excluded from health and safety legislation. They can't refuse dangerous living working conditions. They can't form health and safety committees. Again, this is the apartheid reality that we're talking about. And there's a reason why certain policies are introduced, because people like Ned Livingston Peart, people like those Mexicans whose names I don't know, they can be better exploited. And I can go on and on. There's so many of these names. And more recently, in the last few years, we've had something that was introduced with the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act called the Security Certificate. Security Certificate, which allows the Canadian government to arrest and to detain and to deport an individual based on secret evidence. secret evidence that is not heard in an open hearing, that is heard in a so-called ex parte hearing, away from the defense attorneys, but just with the Crown, the judge, and CSIS. These security certificates have been used in the last 2 years, since they've been introduced with the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, almost exclusively against Arab and Muslim men who are rounded off the street. We have names like Mahmoud Jabala, who's been detained since August 2001, in isolation. He has 6 kids, the oldest of which is 14. He hasn't been able to touch his kids since August of 2001 because he's in isolation. Hassan Almeri, Mohamed Majoub, Mohamed Harkat, Adil Charkari, who was picked off the street in Montreal in May of this year, May 2003, a Moroccan. In all these cases, a security certificate is being used against these men, and they don't know the evidence against them. I personally have no idea if they're guilty or if they're innocent. Their lawyers have no idea if they're guilty or they're innocent because they're not allowed to see the evidence. That's the reality, this apartheid reality being used against Muslim and immigrant communities. Beyond the fact that these 5 men that I mentioned have been picked off the street, what's created is a chill effect that's meant to scare an entire community of Muslim and Arab men who, if they happen to be outspoken on a given issue, might be targeted by CSIS, it might be targeted by the Canadian state. It's important that we look in a little detail at all these cases. I'm not going to look at all the cases, but again, as I said, you have people who've been charged, and they don't even know the evidence against them. The way one lawyer described it is, it's you're a boxer, and you're in a room, and you know there's an opponent, but the room is completely dark, and all you can do is just swing away, and you have no idea who your opponent is. That's the nature of these security certificates. Judges are basically relying just on the evidence of what CSIS might say. And, you know, I have a lot to say about CSIS, and I'm going to say a bit about CSIS and how they're being used against immigrant and refugee populations. CSIS is supposedly now the expert on determining whether somebody is a terrorist threat and determining whether or not Mahmoud Jabala or Adil Charkawi or these other men who've lived in Canada for several years are going to be deported away from their families into dangerous situations. One lawyer in Toronto, Rocco Galati, was able to cross-examine one of these so-called CSIS experts on the Middle East, who only goes by the first name of David. His identity was hidden in this open court, so we can't even, you know, look into this guy and see what he really knows. It was in the case of Mahmoud Jabala, who, by the way, was arrested before September 11th, was let go because the court decided there wasn't enough evidence against him. He was re-nabbed after September 11th on a security certificate, and they basically used the same evidence as before, but this time in a secret hearing. But the judge decided that the CSIS agent could be cross-examined by Rocco Galati in an open hearing. And CSIS's so-called Middle East expert was asked, you know, what's an Arabic country? This is from the transcripts, by the way, that appeared in Saturday Night Magazine. What's an Arabic country? He said the Middle East. These are countries that are generally in the Middle East. So he was asked, well, is Iran an Arabic country? He goes, yes, Iran is an Arabic country. And of course, Iran is not an Arabic country. He was asked to name those Arabic countries that are on the North African coast. He couldn't name them. He couldn't give the population of Egypt. Now, maybe, you know, people here didn't know that Iran is not an Arabic country, or you can't name the Arabic countries on the North African coast, or you don't know the population of Egypt. But then again, you're not an expert on the Middle East for CSIS. But David is. And this is the man on whose evidence Mahmoud Jabala is in isolation, potentially being deported to Egypt and eventual death, and not able to see his kids for almost 2 years. Now, as I said, the bulk of the people who've been picked off the street, such as Adil Charkawi, who was picked off the street in Montreal, he has a young child, and there's been a campaign around him in Montreal. They've been Muslim and Arab men. Of course, there's one famous example of someone who's not Muslim and Arab, but against whom a security certificate has been used, and that's a guy by the name of Ernst Zundel, a Holocaust denier, somebody I have really no sympathy for. But what's interesting about the Ernst Zundel case is that the Canadian government could deal with Ernst Zundel, that is, extradite him back to Germany where he's facing charges for denying the Holocaust, or bring him up on hate crimes charges here in Canada. They can do all those things. There's all kinds of ways of dealing with Ernst Zundel. But instead, they went with a security certificate. They went with a security certificate because CSIS and the Canadian government knows very well that there's this criticism. And it gives them the excuse to say, oh, look, we're even-handed. We're dealing with these potential terrorists, and we're dealing with a Holocaust denier. We're not racist. But we should be really skeptical about that. Talking about CSIS really gets me upset, and it doesn't get me upset because of anything about me personally. It gets me upset because of their total incompetence, and their scandalous incompetence, and their criminal incompetence. Something that's emerged and something that's worth talking about in the context of a No One Is Legal campaign, something that's emerged in the last few weeks. The worst terrorist attack in Canadian history was in 1985. It was when a plane, Air India Flight 182, exploded on the Atlantic, on the top of the Atlantic Ocean, and over 329 people were killed. It took 18 years for that case to come to trial. What's so scandalous is the role of CSIS in relation to Air India. The same CSIS that now are these expert witnesses against various Arab and Muslim men in Canada who are languishing in isolation in detention centers in Ontario and in Quebec. Back in 85, as has now emerged, we now learn that there's the potential that CSIS had a mole within the Air India conspiracy. Somebody who knew that something was going to happen, but who they pulled out. That man has been named. His name is Sirjan Singh Gill, who now lives in London, who was never charged. CSIS had surveillance tapes of the prime suspects, surveillance of what they were talking about on the phone in the months and in the days prior to the bombing. Those tapes were destroyed a year after the bombing. They were destroyed. And I'm not for surveillance or anything, but you know, those tapes could tell us a lot about whether these men are guilty or innocent. This is a scandal, a criminal scandal, an incredible scandal, perhaps what I think is the worst scandal in Canadian history. You know, we learn about in Canadian history the Pacific scandal when there were some corrupt railway men who got money, you know, to build a CPR and all this and that. CSIS is the Canadian Security and Intelligence Service, I'm sorry, which is our CIA or what have you. This is just scandalous. It's criminal because you have an agency, this our spooks, our spies, that might have known about a terrorist attack and did nothing to stop it, that waited 18 years to provide the evidence to bring something to trial, that destroyed evidence that could tell us if these people were, these two men, Rupdaman Singh Malik and Abjayab Singh Bagli, whether they're guilty or innocent, and that's all destroyed. And that was 18 years ago. The same CSIS that's now, you know, determining, you know, that certain people are terrorist threats to our country. It's just scandalous. That mole story is really important because there used to be a joke, there still is a joke actually in the Punjabi and also in the Tamil community that, you know, when you come to Canada, you know, you go through immigration, you go to the welfare office, and then CSIS visits you to get you to be an informant. And in the case of some of these men, such as Aldil Shakarwi, a Moroccan man who's lived in Canada for over 5 years, he has a young child. He was visited by CSIS to become an informant on the Moroccan community. He refused. He says, I'm not going to be an informant. I mean, I think it's fair speculation to wonder whether the security certificate used against Aldil Shakarwi and this grudge against this man is because he refused to be an informant against his own community. Again, this is the creation of an incredible chill effect on huge segments of our population. Back in the early 1990s, to deal with the rise in white supremacy, in neo-Nazis, in Toronto and elsewhere in Canada, CSIS had one of their own moles in these groups who created their own group called the Heritage Front. So, I mean, CSIS and the RCMP worked together to create a white supremacist organization, which I remember because they set up a hotline which had racist and nauseous messages against immigrants and refugees. They created a white supremacist group to supposedly fight white supremacy. It became a huge scandal at the time. And under the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, these are the people who are deciding the realities of so many immigrants and refugees in our country today. Like I said, it's scandalous on so many levels. It's especially scandalous when we recognize in this climate of terrorism, the worst terrorist attack in Canadian history, 329 people who were killed, their conduct there is scandalous, and they might have even been responsible for the terrorist attack. And the Canadian government refuses to even do the simple thing and to call a public inquiry into what happened. Let's hear from these agents. You know, where are they 18 years from now? What are these CSIS agents doing now that back then were destroying tapes, that were putting moles in terrorist conspiracies that resulted in the deaths of over 300 people? So I've been going on quite a bit here. I'm going to start wrapping up. And wrapping up by applying this analysis around migration and around borders and around the lived reality of immigrants and refugees to some of our current movements. For example, the peace movement or the anti-war movement and the globalization movement. And to do so in a very critical way. Because looking at our reality through the lens of migration, through the lens of how it affects people in a very racist way, makes us look at these movements in a totally different way as well. In Montreal, for example, we had some of the largest demonstrations against the war in North America. During one of those days of action, we had the largest demonstration. We had over 200,000 people, which outnumbered people in New York and San Francisco. And that was good. You know, it's good that people came out against the war, but we also have to be wary about the way in which peace politics and anti-war politics were expressing themselves, especially in the ways in which they reinforce the continued scapegoating of immigrants and refugee populations. You know, talking about peace isn't enough. We need to talk about dignity and justice. We need to have an analysis in this peace movement which doesn't talk about racism as something that's incidental, but something that's integral to understanding the whole dynamic of war and who's being affected and who's being directly affected and giving space for those issues to show themselves. To give you an idea of just how stunning this racism is and how it's being expressed, just to give three examples, in Montreal at these rallies, there were a lot of French flags that were being waved because Jacques Chirac was opposed to the war in Iraq, because Jacques Chirac wanted contracts for French companies, and the best way to get those contracts is not to go to war, and Tony Blair wanted contracts for British companies, and the best way to do that is to go to war. Meanwhile, while Jacques Chirac is opposing the war, and meanwhile, activists in Montreal are carrying banners that say Vive la France and you know, way to go Chirac, France is implementing some incredibly regressive policies against immigrant and refugee populations in France itself. In Australia, to give you an idea of this racism, as I mentioned, there's these ferries and these boatloads of immigrants from countries like Iraq, from Afghanistan. They're trying to get to Australia. Just before an election in 2001, senior Australian politicians were putting out this story that these migrants on these boats were trying to throw their kids off as a way of showing their desperation. We're going to throw their kids off the boat and drown them to, you know, try to get Australia to accept them as refugees. And the Australian politicians who were commenting at the time were saying things like, you know, this gives you an idea of the lack of good faith of these people, and, you know, they don't care about their kids, and Australia will not be intimidated by these Iraqis and these Afghanis that are going to throw their kids into the ocean as a way of getting us to accept them. Well, of course, the story was a complete falsehood and a complete lie. There were Iraqis and Afghanis on those boats holding up their children and saying, look, we have children, we're on this boat, accept us. But the idea that somehow an Iraqi or an Afghani is somehow less conscious of or less willing or more willing to take the life of their children, just nonsense. It's just total racism. And this all goes into how we should be looking at our peace movements and our anti-globalization movements. In Ontario, they're going to go to an election soon. They were supposed to go, but because of the SARS scare, they haven't called the election yet. But in Ontario, Ernie Eves and Bob Runciman, Ernie Eves is the premier and Bob Runciman is the public security minister, they've sort of tipped their hand in terms of how they want to win this election after almost a decade of Mike Harris in power. They've talked about wanting to have provincial control of immigration to deal with these waves of immigration. They want to bring in what they call Australian-style immigration policies. Australian-style immigration policies are detaining people immediately and not letting them even get into your country. Ernie Eves, the Premier of Ontario, also said that he wants to stop welfare recipients from sponsoring immigrants to come to the country. What's so absurd about that is that's already the case. Under the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, welfare recipients can't sponsor anyone to come to this country. So either Ernie Eves is a moron, or he's implementing a racist strategy, and he knows full well what he's saying. And Ernie Eves is not a moron. Mel Lastman, the mayor of Toronto, is a moron. But Ernie Eves is not a moron. He's a relatively intelligent guy. He knows exactly what he's doing. Welfare, immigrants, too many immigrants, September 11th. It just pushes all the right buttons for them to win in Ontario, everywhere except in Toronto, where this is considered, you know, well, most people consider this to be totally racist. This is the war at home. Australian politicians, you know, talking openly, again, publicly on mainstream broadcasts, not to some, you know, esoteric audience of Christian fundamentalists or something. No, they're talking to mainstream audiences in Ontario, in Australia, in France. This is the climate of the war at home that isn't quite being implemented into the politics of peace and to the politics of fighting globalization. One way within the anti-globalization movement that this plays out is the what I call the fetishization of national sovereignty, that our opposition to the WTO or the opposition to the FTA is always within the framework of national sovereignty. And that's problematic in two ways. One way that's problematic is that constituency that, again, is somewhat nostalgic for the 1950s or what have you, is not that constituency of people who are directly affected by these racist policies. So it's sort of discounting that reality, which might reflect why there's the so-called whiteness of the movement. And secondly, the discourse of national sovereignty reinforces these very policies, reinforces this control of borders that is making people's lives that much more difficult, that much more inhumane. So those are just a few comments on globalization politics. So I'm going to wrap up here. And by way of wrapping up, I want to say a couple of things. One is the importance within a No One Is Legal campaign to recognize a very basic injustice, and not just recognize it, but act on it. And that is the fact that when we're talking about open borders, we're talking about open borders on stolen land. We're talking about open borders in a context of colonialism and genocide against indigenous peoples. And the No One Is Legal campaign, various open borders campaigns, is not just about the direct frontline struggles of immigrants and refugees, but also of indigenous peoples. I don't want to be naive. There's a lot of tensions and contradictions when it comes to trying to link up struggles of immigrant and refugee populations and indigenous struggles. To give one example, when one of those boatloads of Chinese came off the coast of BC, in Port Alberni, a town on the northern tip of Vancouver Island, there were two women that held up a big banner that said, go home, or words to that effect. Those two women were indigenous women. So, you know, there are tensions and contradictions. That's one, you know, perhaps extreme example of those tensions and contradictions. But there's a lot of room for alliances, of shared analysis. One of those basic shared analyses is the fact is that issue of displacement. When we talk about open borders, when we talk about No One Is Legal, we're talking about having a zero displacement policy. We're talking about dealing with the root causes of why people migrate and not blaming the migrants for those root causes. Let's deal with those root causes, Plan Pueblo Panama, the free trade area of the Americas, war in Afghanistan and in Iraq, these industrial policies in China, bankrolled by the World Bank and the IMF and Canadian and American corporations, that forces people to move. Those are the reasons for displacement. And of course, when we talk about displacement in the context of colonial context of Canada, with regards to indigenous peoples, these are displaced peoples. Peoples that have been displaced from traditional lands onto reserves. In one of the implementations of the original form of apartheid, you know, apartheid was borrowed from Canada by the South Africans. Our great contribution to world culture is not just Wayne Gretzky and maple syrup. It's also this policy of reservations and bantustans, which was given to Australia. So that shared analysis and the understanding to talk about our neo-colonial realities, those realities I talked about global apartheid, about the nature of migration, those are neo-colonial realities. When states like Israel or states like the rich Arab states, Saudi Arabia and others, are also countries that are accepting these migrants, not accepting them, but taking them in to do dirty work and treating them in very exploitive conditions, that's a reflection of a neo-colonial reality. But these neo-colonial realities presuppose something else. Colonial realities, and that's essential. That linkage is essential. The No One Is Legal campaign in Montreal, for example, is beginning to work in solidarity with Grassy Narrows, that frontline struggle in northwestern Ontario against displacement, against the clear-cutting of their land, that fight for self-determination. I was there with other people here in Winnipeg, and Judy De Silva, who's one of the activists there, she asked me, what would bring you here? What would bring someone who's involved with the No One Is Legal campaign here? And I talked to her about displacement and other things. And this is after, by the way, I asked a lot of naive city boy questions about clear cuts and mosquitoes and those kind of things. I'm not used to the country. In any case, there was a huge amount of shared analysis and shared struggle there. In Montreal, where non-status Algerians have been fighting for their right to self-determination, their right to determine their destinies and to live in Canada, Mohawk elders from Kanisataki and Ganawaki have welcomed them with open arms, have said, you know, we're not going to let this divide and rule create this tension between these two communities. These policies are a form of collective punishment. These safe third country policies or these security certificates implemented by CSIS, they're a form of collective punishment because if you're Arab or if you're Muslim, you're forced to answer for every other Arab and Muslim that lives in the world. You have to answer for them, which is why these policies are being implemented. Imagine if every white man had to answer for Timothy McVeigh, and we forced you to register, right? Because Tim McVeigh bombed Oklahoma. But this is a form of collective punishment that's being aimed at very specific populations. We have to call it as such. We have to use those words. We have to give that strength and that power and that clarity to those movements that we're part of, whether it's a peace movement, anti-war movement, globalization, etc. This movement has to be based on that lived reality of what it means to be a refugee and an immigrant or a migrant. That lived reality means fake passports. It means being smuggled. Smuggling and trafficking should be understood as two different things. Trafficking is when you're exploiting somebody, you're forcing them to go somewhere to work, for example, in the sex trade or to work in a sweatshop. Smuggling is the act of moving somebody from one place to another or something, right? And smuggling can be exploitive. You force people to pay or what have you, but it's that act. Under the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, smuggling and trafficking are considered the same thing. And under the new policies, to smuggle somebody is to face life in prison. It's equated with murder and with rape under the criminal code now. Let's remind ourselves what smuggling is. You know, like I said, it's moving somebody from one place to another. There are some famous smugglers in history. For example, Harriet Tubman was a smuggler. Harriet Tubman was a woman who helped bring freed slaves into Canada. She was a smuggler. She helped move people from point A to point B, just like there are people doing that today. There are two people in Canadian history who have received honorary citizenships. One of them is Nelson Mandela, who's pretty well known. The other one maybe is not quite as well known. I'm not sure if anybody knows who's been awarded the second honorary Canadian citizenship. He was awarded it before Nelson Mandela was. It's a guy by the name of Raoul Wallenberg. Raoul Wallenberg was a Swedish diplomat, and in World War II, Raoul Wallenberg provided fake passports to Jewish refugees so they can flee to other countries. Raoul Wallenberg was a smuggler. I'm not saying every smuggler is of the caliber of a Raoul Wallenberg or a Harriet Tubman, but that act of moving people from one place to another is legitimate. It's happening. Throughout the 1980s, we had something called a sanctuary movement, where church people in Texas and Arizona, all over the U.S., would smuggle in Latin American migrants because the U.S. wouldn't accept them as refugees, and they were fleeing dangerous situations. So that lived reality is important. I mean, we're dealing with illegality, but that's the lived reality. That's what makes people illegal. The fact that moving from point A to point B, something that so many of us take for granted, is considered illegal. It goes beyond talking about fair immigration. You know, this isn't about talking about fair immigration, talking about good immigrants versus bad immigrants, that whole dynamic. I mean, it's hard to think of what fair immigration really means in the whole context that I described, because the whole point is to keep people out, and if they get in, is to control them and to set up policies that allows them to be exploited. So what is fair immigration? I mean, is fair immigration having softer handcuffs when you put people in jail? Is fair immigration, you know, being nice when you deport people? It's a whole conceptual switch. Which brings me to my last point, which is we need to recognize the astounding and the profound act of self-determination that goes into being a migrant and is never recognized as such. So to give some examples, real examples, when a young Algerian family, for example, decides to get a fake passport because that's their only way to get out of Algeria and to flee what they believe to be a dangerous situation, and they use those fake passports and they lie to immigration agents to get into England and eventually make their way to Canada and to make a life and to live there for 7 years and to fight to this day to stay in Canada. That's an extraordinary act of self-determination. It's never recognized as such. Our communities, Winnipeg, Toronto, Montreal, wherever, are full of people, migrants, people who came here, who are exercising incredible journeys, incredible acts of self-determination. And they're never recognized as such. And actually, people are meant to feel ashamed of those acts of self-determination. They're meant to feel ashamed and to hide who they are and where they come from. So what a No One Is Legal campaign is about getting beyond that shame, rejecting that shame, using that reality, that act of self-determination as the basis to fight back. There's no such thing as illegal human beings, and there's no such thing as illegal immigrants. Instead, there are illegal states and inhumane policies, and that's the kind of shift we need to move forward.
Asking me for passport, here it is, sir. Maxi. Paid for and forged, only yesterday.